This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, constitutional scholar and our own co-host Stephen Rohde dissects the United States Supreme Court's recent decision, Trump versus the United States of America.
This decision is so important because it establishes the next president of the United States will be above the law. This reverses the gains of the American Revolution.
We'll also speak with attorney Dima Khalidi from Palestine Legal.
The solidarity showed by the American people in support of the Palestinians in Gaza has been extraordinary. Palestine Legal has been the legal arm defending these very brave people.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. On July 1st, the United States Supreme Court handed down one of the most important decisions in the history of our democracy. In the aptly named case of Trump versus the United States, the six arch-conservative justices awarded the ex-president, who appointed three of them, a vast and complex criminal immunity scheme. In three ways, the majority delivered Trump a tailor-made stay-out-of-jail trifecta of expanded constitutional protections for presidents. First, absolute immunity for crimes committed when a president engages in so-called core official acts and a near-conclusive presumption of immunity for other official acts. Second, a brand new rule of criminal procedure making a president's motives irrelevant. And third, another new rule excluding evidence of a president's official acts from a criminal trial for his unofficial acts, which prosecutors offer to prove the ex-president's prior knowledge and intent. To help us understand exactly what the court did and its impact not only on the 91 felony charges currently pending against Trump, but the future of the American presidency and our very democracy, we've asked one of our own co-hosts, Stephen Rohde, to join us. Steve practiced constitutional law for almost 50 years. He's the author of American Words of Freedom, which examines the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. On issues of civil rights, civil liberties, and the American political system, Steve is a regular contributor to Truth Out, L.A. Progressive, the Los Angeles Review of Books, and L.A. Lawyer Magazine. This fall, on Ms. Media, he is launching Speaking Freely, a First Amendment podcast with Stephen Rohde. As you switch seats from co-host to guest, Steve, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here as a guest.
Steve, please explain exactly what the majority did in Trump v. United States and how the conservative justices arrived at their unprecedented decision.
You know, this is a shameful, result-oriented decision. It just adds to this litany in the rogues gallery of some of the most craven and politically driven decisions in Supreme Court history. The title of the case says it all, Donald J. Trump versus the United States of America. In his really hypocritical majority opinion, Chief Justice John Roberts had the audacity to assure us that the president is not above the law, but he and his fellow Republican enablers proceeded to invent sweeping presidential immunity, complete with new special rules of evidence, highly favorable to Trump, that nowhere appear in the Constitution. And none of this has been recognized by the Supreme Court in 235 years. Just so I can break it down for everyone to understand the key holdings in this case, the Supreme Court actually invented three new principles that hadn't existed before. First, they granted absolute immunity for crimes committed when a president engages in core official acts. So it's believed that in the Constitution there are several core acts that only a president can discharge, and the six conservative justices granted Trump and future presidents absolute immunity, and we'll talk more about that. They also, for a zone beyond core official acts, created a form of presumptive immunity, setting a very high bar on how that presumption can be overcome. And then they created brand new rules of criminal procedure, making a president's motives irrelevant. Motives in criminal law are key to a prosecution, and this court has announced that the president's motives are irrelevant. And finally, they created a new rule excluding evidence of a president's official acts from a criminal trial for his unofficial acts. They reassure us that his unofficial acts are still prosecutable, but they've complicated that by saying that then his official acts cannot be introduced in that trial. And that's usually done to prove knowledge, prior knowledge, and the entire circumstances of a crime. So they've hamstrung the prosecution in all of these cases, in all of these ways, and nothing in the Constitution or any legal precedent supports this.
How did the three dissenting judges react?
It was powerful. Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote a blistering, detailed dissent. I think it ran 30 pages. She was joined by now the triumvirate of women progressive judges, including Justice Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson. Just to listen to how Justice Sotomayor characterized the majority opinion, she called it deeply wrong, nonsensical, disastrous, troubling, utterly indefensible, twisted irony, newly minted core immunity, extraordinary, and ultimately a, quote, law-free zone. I've read Supreme Court cases for over 50 years. This is some of the strongest language in a dissent that I've ever read. And instead of following the custom of ending her dissent respectfully, she doesn't say respectfully. She ends it by saying, quote, with fear for our democracy, I dissent. And the bottom line, according to Sotomayor, is as follows, quote, when he uses his official powers in any way, under the majority's reasoning, he now will be insulated from criminal prosecution. Quote, orders the Navy SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival? Immune. Organize a military coup to hold on to power? Immune. Take a bribe in exchange for a pardon? Immune, 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 immune. Now, Justice Jackson wrote her own really analytical dissent, but she likewise called the majority decision flawed reasoning, concocted, breaks new and dangerous ground, devised from whole cloth, oddity, a five-alarm fire, intolerable, unwarranted, and plainly antithetical to bedrock constitutional norms. Justice Jackson highlighted the absurd nature of absolute immunity for core authority. The example she gave is that one of the core methods of authority a president has is appointing and removing members of his cabinet. But Jackson asked, if a president is absolutely immune, can he, quote, remove the attorney general by poisoning him? And that's a legitimate question that a serious Supreme Court justice is asking.
Steve, the six-member conservative majority on the court insists that the Constitution must be interpreted according to the theory of originalism, which focuses, as you know, on the specific text of the Constitution and how it was understood in 1789. Is that how they approach Trump v. United States?
Hardly. This really exposes the hypocrisy of this doctrine of originalism. What the court did is cited some general principles about separation of powers among the legislative, executive, and judicial branches that we all learned in high school, and some vague worries that presidents will be, quote, unduly cautious and not as energetic and vigorous in carrying out their official duties if they face criminal prosecution for breaking the law. Now, this is the same conservative majority when it wanted to reach other results, such as overturning Roe v. Wade in the Dobbs case or striking down sensible gun regulation in the Bruin case, the conservatives insisted that the exclusive method of interpreting the Constitution was strictly confined to the exact text. And as you say, the understanding of that text back in 1789. But now the conservatives cast aside originalism because they have a different agenda. On the question of whether a former president enjoys immunity, Sotomayor wrote, "The majority thinks it should, and so it invents an atextual, ahistorical, and unjustifiable immunity that puts the president above the law." Now, Sotomayor's dissent, and I recommend all listeners to read both of these dissents. They are highly accessible and readable for non-lawyers and lawyers alike. She completely demolishes the majority on this issue. She makes it very clear the framers intentionally declined to grant any form of presidential immunity for crimes committed while in office. She confirms the framers knew how to provide immunity. They did so for members of Congress in the speech and debate clause. And she adds historical support for this proposition. In 1998, in a legal memo by the infamous Kenneth Starr in his investigation of Bill Clinton, his memo said, had the framers wanted to create some constitutional privilege to shield the president from criminal indictment, they would have done so, and they didn't. Now, what she does is she goes through the historical nature of the Constitutional Convention. She quotes James Madison, who was aware that there were immunity provisions in state constitutions for governors. So he asked the body at the Constitutional Convention, would they consider privileges for the executive? And there's no record of the subject being put on the agenda, and certainly there's no provision in the U.S. Constitution for such an immunity. She also pointed out that in Federalist 69, Alexander Hamilton confirmed that presidents would be liable to prosecution and punishment in the ordinary course of law. And during the ratification debates, it was commented that if a president does a single act by which the people are prejudiced, he is punishable himself. There's much more history in Sotomayor's opinion. Richard Nixon accepted his pardon by acknowledging his exposure to criminal prosecution. And finally, perhaps the most damning evidence comes from Trump himself. A lot of listeners will remember the second impeachment trial in 2021. And to encourage senators not to vote to convict him, Trump's impeachment counsel assured them as follows, and I quote, quote, no former office holder is immune from, quote, investigation, prosecution, and punishment, and if any thought he committed a crime, quote, after he is out of office, you can go and arrest him. That's Trump's lawyers promising the senators that there was no immunity. This is a shameful example of result-oriented jurisprudence, if you can even call it that, by the conservative majority.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with Attorney Heidi Boghossian. You're listening to Law and Disorder. We have now on the other side of the microphone Steve Rohde, our constitutional law expert and our co-host, but this time he's speaking about the horrific decision that the Supreme Court handed down granting Trump immunity. Steve, the conservative majority relied heavily on one previous case called Nixon versus Fitzgerald. Does it actually support criminal immunity for presidents?
The short answer is no. This is duplicitous judging by this court. Nixon versus Fitzgerald was a case from 1983. It was a civil lawsuit. A federal employee sued former President Nixon for money damages for allegedly firing him from a government job without lawful cause. The court found that in that circumstance, an ex-president had absolute immunity from civil lawsuits. But in their thorough dissents, Sotomayor and Jackson explain at length how the balancing test applicable in civil lawsuits does not automatically apply to criminal prosecutions. And in fact, the Fitzgerald case itself, that court observed that, quote, there is lesser public interest in actions for civil damages than, for example, in criminal prosecutions. And there's a vast difference. The probability of criminal liability is much smaller. Federal criminal prosecutions require a whole series of robust safeguards, such as the Justice Department's policies on scrupulous impartial prosecution. The entire grand jury process exists in criminal cases. The availability of pretrial motions and the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt and a unanimous jury verdict. Beyond all that, there's a public interest in federal criminal prosecution of a former president that doesn't exist in when an individual sues for money damages. Chief Justice Warren Burger, concurring in Fitzgerald, emphasized that. He said that immunity granted in that case was, quote, limited to civil damage claims rather than, quote, criminal prosecution. And even the four dissenters in that case agreed that a contention that the president is immune from criminal prosecution is not credible. So the dissenters pointed out that when you bring a criminal case, it's in the name of the United States. As long ago as 1892, the court recognized the nature, the distinctive nature of federal criminal law. And instead, once again, the majority blatantly ignored all of that precedent and also existing precedent. Judges are immune in civil rights lawsuits from money damage claims, but they are subject to criminal prosecution just like other citizens, according to a Supreme Court case that was unanimous. And it held that that never suggested that the policy considerations which compel civil immunity for certain governmental officials also place them beyond the reach of the criminal law. So you can see ample authority that could easily have led the court to distinguish between civil cases and criminal cases. And so why did the court reject that sensible path? And I've come to conclude It's because that's not what they were sent to the court to do. They are the judicial arm of Trump's Republican Party, and their job is to protect their leader, even at the cost of defiling the Constitution.
Yes, Steve, and it's becoming clear to the public that that was their task. What is the immediate impact of Trump v. United States on the 91 felony charges Trump faces?
This is very ominous. There are prosecutions pending, as you know, New York, Washington, Florida, and Georgia. Just one day after the Trump immunity case was decided, his sentencing for his May 30 conviction on 34 felony counts in the New York so-called hush money case was delayed. He was ready to be sentenced on July 11, and it was delayed until September 18. In announcing that delay, the judge rather ominously said, this will hold sentencing, quote, if such is still necessary, suggesting that the Trump decision could play a pivotal role in Trump's upcoming motion to set aside the verdict on the grounds that some of the evidence introduced at trial now is precluded under the new Supreme Court rulings. So the prosecutors and judges in all these cases will now have to analyze the convoluted nature of this case, distinguish core powers from marginal powers, distinguish official conduct from unofficial conduct, and then figure out how this all applies to the specific indictments in all these cases. It's going to take months. There'll be appeals that will go all the way back to the Supreme Court. It will be a convoluted process, and sitting on high, the Supreme Court can again review all of those motions and all of those appeals to detect whether the courts have been sufficiently deferential to Trump in those cases. And if they find any flaws or errors, they can send all those cases back again. I wanted to add, because many of your listeners know that there were civil verdicts, the $5 million and $83 million defamation judgments. And believe it or not, this case now casts doubt on those cases. Back then, William Barr, when he was Attorney General, he actually suggested that Trump's statements, his defamatory statements, were said in his, quote, official capacity. That's the argument Barr made years ago. It was a ridiculous argument at the time, and now it has the imprimatur of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Steve, as we come to a close of the program, can you look ahead to the long-term implications of this decision? And is there anything our listeners can do other than wring their hands and lose sleep?
Given that we already knew this was a very dangerous time for democracy, it has only gotten more dangerous. I cannot sugarcoat that for anyone listening and anyone who studies this opinion. It was really captured by the dissenters when they were summing up what we are facing. Sotomayor wrote that, quote, in every use of official power, the president is now a king above the law. The court effectively creates a law-free zone around the president, upsetting the status quo that has existed since the founding. The immunity the court created now, quote, lies about like a loaded weapon, unquote, for any president to use for their own political gain or financial interests, quote, with the knowledge that they are inoculated from criminal liability. Justice Jackson sounded a similar alarm that U.S. presidents would be kings under the court's ruling. Quote, "The majority of my colleagues seem to have put their trust in our court's ability to prevent presidents from becoming kings through case-by-case application of the indeterminate standards of their new presidential accountability paradigm," she wrote. Quote, "I fear that they are wrong." The court has declared for the first time, she pointed out, that, quote, "the most powerful official in the United States can become a law unto himself," unquote. She concluded that from this day forward, quote, "presidents of tomorrow will be free to exercise the commander-in-chief powers for foreign affairs powers and all the vast law enforcement powers enshrined in Article II, however they please, including in ways that Congress has deemed criminal and that have potentially grave consequences for the rights and liberties of Americans." She did conclude by invoking the power of the people. She cited the role, the collective role that the people have, the ultimate deciders in our representative system. And that does bring us to the last part of your question of what can listeners do? I don't think we're powerless. I don't think a decision like this has to be accepted and we lay down those powers of the people that Justice Jackson invoked. I see at least three things can be done, and there may be more as we analyze this case and look ahead. Trump's second term poses no threat to America if he doesn't get a second term. And that power of the vote is in the hands of the American people. Whoever the Democratic candidate is in November, I can say this without any restraints of any nonprofit organization around me, that Trump must be defeated. We must rally. We must convince the American people that he posed such a serious threat in the 4 years he was in office, in the time he's been out of office, in the face of the Project 2025 agenda. And imagine him in office, now wrapped in the immunity that this court has bestowed upon him. It is terrifying, and we've got to organize with all of that in mind. Secondly, in a longer-term way, it's a constitutional amendment. Supreme Court cases can be reversed by constitutional amendment, and it's happened in the past. It's a huge struggle to pass a constitutional amendment. It first has to pass through both houses of Congress and go out to the people. But it's happened before, and it can happen again. And this, I can't imagine a more important Supreme Court decision that needs to be reversed by constitutional amendment. Thirdly, there is articles of impeachment have been filed in the House to impeach Justices Thomas and Justice Alito. We don't have time today to rehearse the ethical violations. Those two justices and the justices appointed by Trump should not have sat in this case. They should have recused themselves for sitting in judgment of Donald Trump. That's what the American people can do to organize around that. Elections are not only about a president, they are about the appointment of Supreme Court justices. There are moves to expand the number of justices and to put term limits in effect. And this conservative court has taught us you can overturn precedent just by the strike of a pen, as they did with Roe v. Wade. And Trump v. United States can be overturned by a future Supreme Court. But it's that kind of work among the American people it will take.
Steve, thank you for one of our most consequential segments in the history of Law and Disorder. Aside from listening to you on the show, where can listeners follow what you're doing and writing?
Folks can find my work at LARB, the LA Review of Books. I also write for Truth Dig and the LA Progressive and other publications. I try to use as much as I can my own power of free speech to communicate these important issues with the public.
Please mention your upcoming podcast.
Beyond all that, I'm very pleased that through Ms. Media this fall, I will be having a regular podcast called Speaking Freely, a First Amendment podcast with Stephen Rohde. We'll publicize that widely. I take a hard look at the key Supreme Court cases throughout its history on freedom of speech, which is the backbone of all of our freedoms. And I hope our Law and Disorder listeners will tune in to Speaking Freely.
Thank you so much, Steve, and we'll be in touch very soon.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
How does it feel when it's quiet and calm? And will I be will it feel when it's time to move on? Mother says kneel and pray. When it gets hard, I will roll those sleeves. Life can be so unkind.
The resistance organization Palestine Legal, headquartered in Chicago, was created by our own Michael Ratner and others to resist our government's practice of what Michael called the Palestine exception to the First Amendment. This exception to the supposedly protected First Amendment activity of speaking out and organizing by Palestinian solidarity activists is carried out by the repression of the U.S. government nationally and locally. It has never been more ferocious than it is now. However, the mobilization against the Israeli genocide, carried out with total U.S. support, has not been undeterred by peak anti-Palestinian repression. Palestine Legal has been in the vanguard in defending and promoting the rights of people expressing solidarity with the Palestinians in Gaza. We speak today with attorney Dima Khalidi, the founder and director of Palestine Legal. She's Palestinian, born in Beirut, and raised in the United States. Dima Khalidi, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's great to be with you all.
Dima, our own Michael Ratner came back from visiting the West Bank in the Israeli militarily occupied territory about 10 years ago and was powerfully affected by what he experienced. He then was instrumental in setting up Palestine Legal. Please tell us about your relations to Michael and talk about Palestine Legal.
Yeah, we're thinking a lot about Michael these days. He was really instrumental in conceiving of Palestine Legal. He deeply understood the need for a legal response to the backlash that Palestine advocates were facing. And this was, you know, in the early 2010s when we began talking about this need as we saw increasing legal repression. Lawsuits, criminal prosecution of protesters at the University of California, Irvine, and other examples of just the extent to which Palestine activists were being censored and thwarted by legal threats and actions. And based on his experience doing movement defense work in the 1980s with activists organizing around Central America and all of his other movement lawyering work, he really encouraged me in particular, as I was, you know, thinking about the kind of work we can do in the United States around Palestine, to focus on the movement here and what kind of legal support it needed. And of course, he was also dedicated to getting accountability for Israel's crimes. And even before this current crisis, he recognized since 1947, Israel has been committing war crimes and genocide and apartheid. And he worked alongside, with CCR as president of CCR, and encouraged litigation that was trying to hold Israeli officials accountable for various war crimes and whatnot. You know, thinking a lot about what he would be doing today as we're witnessing this brutal phase of this genocide live on our screens. But in the last years of his life, he was even more dedicated after he actually went to the West Bank for the first time, to the occupied Palestinian territories. And, you know, he really helped guide Palestine Legal in its early years. He knew the importance of documenting what was happening and pushed us to publish our first report, which is called The Palestine Exception to Free Speech, which, you know, he kind of coined that phrase. For us, he is a model. His life work has been a model of movement lawyering for our generation, marrying the legal and the political and using the law as a tool to support and protect and advance these movements, critical movements that are working for fundamental changes to the status quo that always puts profits over people and the planet. So, you know, we miss him a lot these days. And Palestine Legal is one of his many legacies now. We're 12 years into the organization. We're in a massive crisis that is seeing a tsunami of repression against people who are daring to oppose this genocide and the ideology of Zionism that fuels it, and the U.S.'s complicity in it all. And obviously this repression is a reaction to the incredible movement that has arisen, that has grown over the last couple of decades in particular, and is very powerful. And is, you know, we've seen, especially in the last 8 months with this genocide unfolding, hundreds and millions of people really rising up to try to put a stop to what our governments are allowing. So it's a critical moment for the work that we do that is really driven to support, protect, and advance the movement for Palestinian rights in the U.S. through legal support, through advocacy, through communications work to get our people's narrative out there when there is such a crushing and overwhelming narrative that tries to undermine and criminalize us, right? So we've been working nonstop over the last 8-9 months to provide people who are being targeted for their Palestine advocacy with legal support. And, you know, we're building a network of politically minded lawyers to help respond to this incredible, incredible backlash that we're seeing right now.
Dima, speaking of this, as you know, the ongoing genocide of the Palestinian people, who once numbered 2.3 million in the tiny Gaza Strip, has been conducted by Israel with the indispensable American support since October of last year. And as you mentioned, there's been truly a magnificent response of Palestine solidarity in this country, especially at almost 200 college campuses. So what has been the response of the U.S. and the local governments to this?
Well, I think because the U.S. is entirely complicit in what is happening, has in fact enabled it with the weapons that it supplies to Israel to conduct this genocide, with the diplomatic support that it provides. Really, what we're seeing is a repression of this movement in ways that I think mirror repression of the anti-war movement during the Vietnam War, as if it's the U.S.'s own war, almost. And pre-October, we saw all of the same kinds of repression tactics that we're seeing today. They have largely been pushed by Israel and Zionist organizations in the U.S. who have been for years calling on institutions, including universities, and on state agencies to crack down on Palestine advocacy. They've been calling on the Department of Justice to investigate advocacy groups for, you know, allegedly supporting terrorism, for example, completely bogus allegations. They've been pushing for a definition of anti-Semitism that would turn almost any criticism of Israel into a hatred of Jewish people, right? Pushing for legislation that punishes boycotts for Palestinian rights, and over 30 states have obliged and passed such legislation. Getting institutions to punish students or others for their speech activities. But certainly post-October, all of this has been magnified exponentially, and we've seen the state and even private institutions and employers, it's the perfect storm, right? It's the perfect excuse to enact everything that these groups have been building over the last couple of decades. So, you know, in response to the incredible student protests and the encampments in the spring in particular, everybody saw universities in particular calling in the police, often local police forces and National Guards in some instances, to conduct mass arrests of students. They often led to the brutalization of students and professors. We know professors who were brutally beaten and suffered severe injuries, and students, as well as community members who were supporting students. Especially since October, there's been a very explicit targeting of this movement for surveillance and investigation by law enforcement agencies. President Biden himself said, you know, this is a priority under the kind of guise of combating terrorism and anti-Semitism, right? The two labels, the smears that are used against this movement. There has been a huge increase in surveillance of the movement. So we have activists who are being, and community members being visited by the FBI, their social media being surveilled. We are expecting that there could be criminal prosecutions flowing from this period of, you know, increased scrutiny and surveillance of the movement. You know, in addition to that, there our elected officials are pushing racist anti-Palestinian legislation. This existed before October again, but this kind of legislation has proliferated to, for example, try to ban Palestinian immigrants or revoke visas of Palestinians, labeling Palestine activism as pro-terrorist and anti-Semitic and targeting student activism. There's a bill that targets 501c3s, nonprofit organizations, right? Giving the IRS, an IRS official, the power to designate C3 organizations as, quote, terrorist supporting, right? So this this terrorism label is being used to really target the movement. We just published a report called Anti-Palestinian at the Core that really maps the evolution of anti-terrorism laws as a reaction to various crises in Palestine in order to criminalize not only Palestinian resistance, but also advocacy for Palestinian rights. So, you know, this is another phase in this evolution where Zionist groups, Israel and Zionist groups, and their allies in our government are trying to push legislation that further criminalizes even speech activities that support Palestinian rights. I think it's important to mention that a lot of the repression we're seeing is also coming from institutions as well as organizations and individuals. So, you know, universities, in addition to calling in the police to brutalize their students, are enacting excessive disciplinary measures on their students, which includes expulsion and eviction and suspensions and banning student groups. We've seen individuals who have been physically attacked just for being Palestinian or engaging in protests. So the 6-year-old boy who was killed in Chicago by his landlord for being Palestinian, the 3 university students in Vermont who were shot, one of them paralyzed, a protester stabbed in Texas, and on and on. But there are also these censorship campaigns against artists and writers, against speakers at universities, against cultural events. Finally, I think the other development has been lawsuits, again, using the anti-terrorism laws that have been developed specifically to go after Palestinians. And so we're seeing advocacy groups now targeted by civil lawsuits that are trying to hold them accountable for, you know, the actions of Hamas on October 7th, right? So there are these bogus lawsuits ultimately, but they are part of a system of lawfare that has developed that, you know, is aiming to criminalize, to distract, to undermine the movement for Palestinian rights by attacking, you know, the infrastructure of the movement. So, you know, a lot of the repression we're seeing has its basis in not only these false accusations of support for terrorism, but also false accusations of anti-Semitism. These are the kind of narratives and the labels that we have to challenge that are creating this massive anti-Palestinian environment and repression that are fueling the repression of this movement. But, you know, frankly and importantly, we have to connect it to the repression of other movements, to this kind of wave of right-wing repression of attempts to undermine fundamental constitutional rights, right? There is a resurgent fascism that is taking hold, and we have to understand what's happening here and the repression of the Palestine movement as part and parcel of, you know, various other legislative efforts to undermine protest rights, to criminalize protests, to take away reproductive rights, to take away voting rights, and on and on and on. So that connection is so critical to me.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. I'm your host, Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host, Attorney Heidi Boghossian, and we're speaking with the head of Palestine Legal, Attorney Dima Khalidi. Dima, talk about the response of Palestine Legal to this repression. Since October, you've filed 2 lawsuits, provided legal support for hundreds of activists, you've given help to hundreds of lawyers, and you've filed 8 civil rights complaints on behalf of students. So far, the Department of Education has opened up federal investigations into 4 of these complaints. Please talk about this.
Yeah, you know, as I said, there's been a tsunami of repression, and our organization is, you know, its entire mission is to challenge this kind of repression of the movement. Certainly, we have never seen this volume of need in terms of legal support. Just since October, we've gotten about 2,500 requests for support. And this is compared to a couple hundred in a typical year, right? So the volume that we're dealing with is unprecedented. We're not the only ones who are stepping up in this moment. There are a number of other organizations that are supporting as well and getting a number of requests. Unprecedented number of requests. We directly advise, represent, advocate on behalf of a number of individuals and groups. You know, we're responding to a huge number of these intakes, and we're also referring a very large number to a network of lawyers that we're also growing and helping to train up to do this kind of work, to support students in particular, who are the majority of our clients. to have kind of counsel on the ground in different places where they're needed. We have also filed two lawsuits so far. One is against Columbia University, which we filed with the NYCLU on behalf of Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace, the student groups, which were suspended based on ever-changing rules that the administration was placing. We sued them in New York court for basically violating their own speech and other policies and processes. So that case is pending. We also sued with the ACLU, Florida universities, and officials for an order that attempted to ban SJPs based, again, on this false accusation that they supposedly support terrorism. That case was dismissed because the judge saw that the universities had no intention to enforce this order, which was so clearly unconstitutional. So we continue to monitor what's happening in Florida. We have indeed filed what it's now 9 complaints, discrimination complaints against universities with the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights and other partners, including American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, Muslim Advocates, a number of other organizations are also filing such complaints on behalf of students and professors. And these are really exposing anti-Palestinian discrimination that is happening. It's very clear the way that universities are ignoring their Palestinian students' needs. They're dismissing their concerns about their safety because of the severe doxing, harassment, the police violence they're facing. They're, in fact, actively discriminating against their own students. Ironically, under the pretext of protecting Jewish students, you know, this is an example of the way that false accusations of anti-Semitism and the use of this definition of anti-Semitism that conflates anti-Zionism or criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism is actually causing the repression and discrimination against Palestinians and those who are associated or allied with them. So this is a dynamic that we are exposing, and these complaints have led to, as you said, four federal investigations so far, and there are others that have been opened into our partners' complaints as well. This is one avenue that we have to hold universities accountable for the kind of actions that they're taking against their own students. But, you know, there are also many folks around the country who are looking into other ways to hold them accountable through litigation and otherwise. We also are engaged in many other disciplinary hearings, supporting students through disciplinary hearings, and also strategizing with partners and others around the country about other legal avenues to protect folks at this moment, including we have to defend against lawsuits that are targeting movement groups.
Dima, we're unfortunately out of our allotted time. Can you briefly, if you don't mind us asking a personal question, tell us how you got involved in the Palestine Solidarity Movement?
Well, I'm Palestinian, and while I was born abroad, I was raised in the U.S. and from a family that has always been deeply involved in the Palestinian struggle. My father's a historian of Palestinian and Middle East history. It was ingrained from the very beginning for me that that Palestine is a critical issue, and it's not just about Palestine. The issues, the struggle that we have is connected to freedom struggles around the world. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to go to law school, to do something for the cause. And, you know, that's what led me to start Palestine Legal. But, you know, it has been something that has been important to me from the very beginning and important to my family, who, you know, has a long history in Jerusalem and other parts of Palestine.
Dima, how can our listeners follow your work, especially Palestine Legal's most recent report?
We have a website, and I encourage folks to check that out. It's palestinelegal.org. Our recently published report analyzes the wave of repression that I talked about since October, and specifically in the last 3 months of 2023, showing the trends of repression that we're seeing and, you know, the enormous wave of solidarity as well. And that report is available on our website as well. It's called The Reverberations of October 7th, the Mobilization Against Genocide is Undeterred by Peak Anti-Palestinian Repression. And I also encourage just speaking about Michael. You know, we have a fellowship that is dedicated, that is named after him, and a fund that supports that fellowship. So for those of you who knew and loved Michael, that's a beautiful way to also honor his legacy by contributing to that, to the fund that supports the Michael Ratner Justice Fellowship.
Fabulous.
Thank you very much. Thank you, thank you, thank you for being on Law and Disorder. We're certainly grateful for your great work. You be well.
So great to be with you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.